Track one.
Welcome to the East Shropshire Talking Newspaper. And now, over to your presenter.
Welcome to this issue number 1683 of the East Shropshire Talking Newspaper. I'm Simon Martin in the presenter's chair this week, and sitting opposite me is sound engineer John Wardle. We're recording in our studio on the Rekin Housing Group building in Telford on the evening of Tuesday the 4th of November, sandwiched between Halloween and November the 5th with its gunpowder, treason and plot. The 5th of November this year also coincides with a full moon. According to the BBC Weather website, it's a beaver supermoon. It seems that Native American peoples noticed that beavers are much more active at this time of year as they prepare for winter. Who knew? For this issue, the local news stories have been selected and read by Chris and Roy Grain. The general interest items in part two feature Robert Green, Terry Frost and Suzanne Lawler. The Midland News Association give us access to the digital versions of their publications, and we're most grateful for their permission to select and audio record suitable items from the Shropshire Star, the Telford and Bridgnorth Journals, the Market Drayton Advertiser, Newport Advertiser and the monthly Shropshire Magazine. It's now time to hand over to Chris and Roy for the first set of news stories, including solar panels at the Princess Royal Hospital, alcohol licensing, a new play park planned for Shifnal, and first, budget cuts at Telford and Rekin Council.
Cuts and efficiencies of more than £4 million will be needed at Telford and Rekin Council over the next 5 months if it is to stay within budget, a report reveals. Officials at the Labour Council have forecast a massive further increase in care costs for elderly people, which they say has been identified in the last 3 months. Council officers say they will now have to use all their budgeted contingency reserves and make savings to stay within budget. Legal officials will be involved in assessing some of the savings, which may require consultation if there is an impact of any proposed savings on the delivery of statutory services and any other legal matter arising. Unlike Shropshire Council, which is teetering on the edge of bankruptcy, Telford and Rekin Council still has a budget strategy reserve of £21.7 million, which it can use if the situation deteriorates further. Council officers say the council's budget could be under even more pressure in the event of a challenging winter. Council leaders say they cannot and will not compromise on the level of care elderly residents and the most vulnerable in the community deserve. A report set to go to the council's cabinet next week says it will need an additional £14 million to cover the costs of providing adult social care packages through to the end of March 2026. They have forecast, using up contingencies and an added £4 million of savings and efficiencies, to reach a balanced budget. In July, the council was forecasting having some contingencies left. This is in addition to £77 million committed at the start of the year in its revenue budget to fund adult social care. National reports have shown that last year adult social care budgets were overspent by 80% by councils.
A town is set for a new play park amid a £370,000 plan, which includes upgrades for three other play areas. Shifnal Town Council has officially launched the tender process to find a contractor to design and build a landmark new play area in Wheatfield Drive, marking the start of the largest project the council has ever undertaken. The ambitious project includes the development of a dedicated new space targeting teenagers at the Wheatfield Drive site, alongside significant refurbishments of existing parks. The combined budget for all three areas is estimated to be between £320,000 and £370,000, dependent on successful designs. The funding has been sourced solely from the Community Infrastructure Levy that is collected from new housing developments in the town. The tender officially opened at the end of September with interested parties required to submit their designs by December the 5th. The council has said that following the submission phase, the selection process will heavily involve the community. In January, the public will be invited to vote for their top four favourite designs. Then in February, the council will award the contract after narrowing the selection down to two final designs. Work is scheduled to commence in early spring, beginning a rolling programme of improvements across all sites. Mayor of Shifnal, Paul Williamson, expressed his excitement at the plans. He said, "This project is about to deliver on a promise to our community, a promise to provide exceptional, enduring spaces for every resident. We want every child and young person in Shifnal to have access to safe, fun and inclusive play facilities that stand the test of time. This substantial investment is the single largest project our council has ever led."
Water supplier Severn Trent has applied for a drought permit as part of measures to ensure it has enough water for customers next spring and summer. Severn Trent has asked the Environment Agency for permission to continue abstracting water from the River Derwent in Derbyshire over the winter months. The move is designed to help refill its Carsington Reservoir, which remains lower than normal following months of unusually dry weather. Severn Trent said that after a record-breaking dry spring and summer, Carsington Reservoir's level is lower than we want it to be. The drought permit would allow the company to continue taking water from the Derwent, even if river flows remain low, ensuring storage levels are replenished before next year's peak demand period. The water company admitted last week that it is facing a water shortfall this October. Its overall reservoir storage levels have fallen below half capacity, dipping to 49.8% on October 20th, before rising slightly to 53.3% in a reading taken last week. Severn Trent's reservoirs can hold up to 247,000 million litres of water, but contained now 132,078 million litres. A Severn Trent spokesperson said the Midlands was declared as being in drought following a record-breaking dry summer and spring, the driest and warmest on record, which has resulted in less water in rivers and reservoirs. In Derbyshire, we recently applied to the Environment Agency for a drought permit to continue to abstract water from the River Derwent throughout the winter and support the refill of Carsington Reservoir in Derbyshire to help us plan and prepare for summer 2026. The company stressed that the application only applies to Derbyshire, will not affect customers' water supplies or usage in other regions. It said the aim is to make sure the network is well prepared and that it is not leaving anything to chance. It said river levels are normally at their highest during winter, allowing water companies to abstract sufficient volumes to restock reservoirs. However, the Environment Agency's latest dry weather report shows that England received an average of just 20 millimetres of rain between October 17th and 24th, with the West Midlands remaining in drought. Severn Trent said it remains hopeful that rainfall over the coming months will help restore reservoir levels, but added that taking precautionary measures now was the responsible thing to do.
The Environment Agency has handed Severn Trent the top-rated award for the company's environmental performance for the sixth year in a row. The Environment Agency said that Severn Trent has achieved the four-star award in the Environmental Performance Assessment. The assessment was introduced in 2011 as a tool for comparing environmental performance between water companies and across years. Only five water companies have achieved four stars, all at least twice, but Severn Trent is the only company to achieve the top award consistently for the last 6 years. This recognition places Severn Trent as the only top-performing water company in the EA's assessment across key areas, including biodiversity, pollution, prevention and sustainable water management. Liv Garfield, CEO of Severn Trent, said, "Being awarded the top-rated four-star status is testament to the incredible teams at Severn Trent and the real lasting change we're delivering for the environment. It is a result of hard work, major investment over many years, and a strong collaboration with our partners and communities. It's the sixth consecutive year that we've achieved the top-rated award, with a backdrop of tightening environmental standards. 1 year is a milestone, 6 years is an industry record, and our teams are proud of it. And with our largest ever investment programme underway, we're fully focused on driving the environmental improvements our customers and communities expect. As part of the delivery to achieve four-star status in the 2024 assessment period, Severn Trent has completed 580 environmental improvement schemes in just 1 year and achieved 99% compliance with discharge permits across 648 wastewater sites. The Midlands company also said it has delivered the joint best total pollutions reduction performance and the best pollutions performance across the past 5 years. The company also claims to be on track to achieve a seventh consecutive year of four-star environmental performance with a range of initiatives underway. These include upgrades to over 400 sewage pumping stations, £300 million of investment over the next 5 years to reduce pollutions, and the doubling of the rate of mains renewal to reduce leakage.
An MP has warned plans to scrap laws requiring alcohol licensing notices to be published in printed local newspapers will erode the public's right to know what is happening in their communities. The government has announced a consultation on licensing reform, including proposals to remove the statutory requirement for alcohol licensing notices to be advertised in print in local newspapers, which the industry says would shroud local communities in secrecy. Alan Morgan, Liberal Democrat MP for North Shropshire, has also voiced concerns, saying that the public notices in local papers are crucial to ensuring residents have the opportunity to express their thoughts. Mrs. Morgan said, "It is important that people are made aware of any changes taking place in their local area, and public notices are a crucial part of that process, as well as a valuable revenue stream for local news organisations." She also said local papers played a vital role in scrutinising the work of the public sector, and the cutting off a vital stream of revenue could harm the democratic process. "It is important that public bodies and representatives such as myself are held to account, and media organisations are an important part of that process, whether that is online, in broadcast or in print," she said. "Local and regional newspapers such as the Shropshire Star are crucial for democracy, accountability and transparency." Mrs. Morgan said that in principle she welcomed the government's desire to reduce the administrative burden on the hospitality sector and local authorities which, like the news industry, face a significant financial pressure. "However, it is important that the government carefully considers the impact that any changes to licensing will have on local media, and on the local printed press in particular," she added. "The funding crisis for local media has been compounded by the government's decision in the English devolution bill to remove the necessity for local authorities to publish notices in local newspapers." She said her Liberal Democrat colleague, Manuela Pertigalla, MP, had tabled an amendment to the bill which would ensure that at least one of the newspapers in which a public notice is printed is a local paper. Sir Gavin Williamson, Conservative MP for Stone, Great Whirley and Penkridge, has also spoken out against the plans, saying the measures would undermine public accountability. He said it's weakening local democracy and it's weakening the press. That's really bad government and a retrograde step.
Solar panels are set to be installed at a Shropshire hospital to slash energy bills and funnel savings directly into frontline care after an investment of almost £500,000. Great British Energy has awarded £445,000 for solar panels to be installed on a car park canopy at the Princess Royal Hospital, Telford. The 200-kilowatt solar system is scheduled for installation in the new year and is expected to save the Shrewsbury and Telford Hospital NHS Trust around £35,000 annually in energy costs while generating clean, renewable power. The Trust said the project will contribute to wider savings of an estimated £1 million a year in energy costs, which can be redirected into frontline care. In September, the Department for Energy Security and Net Zero announced up to £75 million of investment from Great British Energy and the government to roll out solar panels across military sites, schools and NHS trusts. Inesi Robotham, Assistant Chief Executive and Chair of the SAF Climate Change Group, said, "We are delighted to have been awarded funding to install solar panels on a car park canopy at Princess Royal Hospital in Telford. This is further investment which aligns with our vision of sustainable health services, more modern facilities, creating a better environment for our patients and colleagues. It is a project that will reduce our carbon footprint further and contribute to savings of an estimated £1 million per year."
Track 2. At a recent committee meeting, there was a discussion about compliance with the latest data protection regulations. In order to comply with the legislation, we're changing the way that we acknowledge donations and announce new listeners. It feels rather less personal, but we'll no longer mention individual names. We are, of course, very grateful for each and every contribution we receive, and hopefully just as welcoming if you're new to our service. So, a sincere thank you to everyone who's made donations this last month, and a warm welcome to new listeners to the East Shropshire Talking newspaper. You may well be listening to us on a USB player via memory stick, delivered free of charge by the Royal Mail. Perhaps you listen via a smart speaker, like Amazon's Alexa device or Apple's HomePod. Apple service users also have the choice of Apple Podcasts and iTunes. You can listen on the phone by dialing 01952 935 936. Your phone provider will make a charge as a standard or rate call. Instructions for all the listening options are available on our website, eastshropshiretn.co.uk. There is also a link to the current issue and an archive of the previous 6 months' worth of issues in podcast format. It's always good to get your feedback and comments. You can contact us by phone on 01952 373 007. Please leave a message and we'll get back to you. Alternatively, you can email us at eastshropshiretn@gmail.com or via the contact page on our website. The address again, eastshropshiretn.co.uk. A major contributor, presenter and hard worker here at ESTN, Chris Pitchford has made the decision to step down from his role at this talking newspaper. Chris began volunteering for ESTN 35 years ago at the age of 15. He's been very involved in shaping ESTN to be the professional outfit that it is today. He's served on the committee as vice chair, set up our Google Drive file store, and liaised with the Talking Newspaper Federation over many years. He was instrumental in digitising the newspaper during the COVID years, a major reset which enabled us to continue broadcasting during a very difficult time. Recently, he's been involved in disseminating his radio show, Solid Gold Sounds, to many radio stations nationally, and he's decided to step back from ESTN to concentrate on this, although he'll still be involved in a consultative capacity. All of us here at ESTN thank him for his long involvement, dedication and passion for our charity, and wish him well for the future. In their second batch of news items, Chris and Roy bring us reports of steel trees at Hope House Hospices, soul singer Beverly Knight's new role at Wolverhampton Grand Theatre, and a Christmas raffle in aid of Air Ambulance.
Midlands Air Ambulance Charity is inviting people to make a life-saving difference in their local community by participating in its 2025 Christmas raffle, which has officially launched. The festive fundraiser offers a chance to win big, including a grand prize of £3,000. Every ticket sold directly supports future life-saving missions, enabling the charity's advanced clinical team to respond to the most critically ill and injured patients across Shropshire. In addition to the £3,000 jackpot, there are 16 other cash prizes to be won. Participating in the charity's Christmas raffle will help save lives this festive season, making a real difference for people like Thomas and Becky Kay, who suffered traumatic injuries while getting ready to head out for a family walk on Cannock Chase with their 18-month-old daughter Rosie. They were parked up and strapping Rosie into her backpack carrier when, without warning, a car veered off the road, collided with their parked vehicle, which was then shunted directly into them. It all happened so fast, and a normal family outing ended with us suffering life-changing injuries and needing urgent treatment, Thomas recalls. Thanks to the incredible care from Midlands Air Ambulance Charity and the emergency services, we were able to begin the long road to recovery, something we're forever grateful for. Becky still lives with ongoing pain and some limitations, but through it all, we've discovered just how much resilience and love we have as a family. In March 2023, we were overjoyed to welcome our second child, Sam, and now we just enjoy every moment together. Emma Wood, head of fundraising and engagement at Midlands Air Ambulance Charity, said, "Last year, the generous support of those who purchased tickets for our Christmas raffle made 33 air ambulance missions and 37 critical care missions possible. Our charity does not receive any government funding and relies entirely on support from the local communities we serve. So by participating in this year's raffle, you'll be making a vital difference to our essential emergency service, helping to keep families together this Christmas while also having a chance to win an incredible cash prize. Each year, the charity is tasked with raising £16 million to stay operational and deliver life-saving pre-hospital emergency care, meaning each raffle ticket purchased will directly support the critical care team and fund their vital work. The Christmas raffle is open to anyone aged 18 and over. Each ticket costs £1, and entrance unique raffle ticket numbers will be automatically entered to the prize draw. The closing date for postal entries is Monday, December the 15th, and the closing date for online entries is Thursday, December the 18th, and the draw itself will take place on Monday, December the 22nd. To buy a raffle ticket and help make missions possible this Christmas, please visit midland-airambulance.com/christmas-raffle. To find out more about Midlands Air Ambulance Charity, visit midlandsairambulance.com and follow the organisation on social media.
The region's ambulance service has joined in a national campaign to offer thanks and celebrate the people who wear headsets and work to help patients every day. West Midlands Ambulance Service was joined in International Control Room Week, a week dedicated to celebrating the unsung heroes of control rooms from across the country. The WMAS Trust operates two emergency operations centres based in Briley Hill and Stafford, and last year it received 1.5 million emergency 999 calls, which on average were answered in less than 1 second. Jeremy Brown, Emergency Operations Centre and Operational Planning Director, said, "It's a big responsibility being that voice on the end of the phone when someone calls 999 for help, as often it's that caller's very worst day. Our call assessors are trained to deal with every eventuality, remaining calm and focused to get the vital information needed to determine the right care for that patient as quickly as possible. I am exceptionally proud of my team despite all the pressures they face. They always have patient care at the heart of everything they do.
Queen of British Soul Music has said that becoming the first patron of her home city theatre is an honour and very exciting. Beverly Knight has been announced by Wolverhampton Grand Theatre as its first ever patron, saying it marked an exciting new chapter in the theatre's rich history of performance, community engagement and charitable work. Beverly's new role as patron will see her actively support the theatre's charitable trust, with an emphasis on education and artistic development, and she will also serve as an ambassador for the theatre's artistic vision. Speaking about her appointment, Beverly said, "It's an incredible honour to become the first patron of Wolverhampton Grand Theatre, a venue that I made my first stage appearance, and more recently, in Murray and Rosetta. I'm excited to support the wonderful community projects like the Memory Cafe and help nurture the next generation of performers and audiences." A spokesman for Wolverhampton Grand Theatre said, "As one of the region's most respected and recognisable stage talents, Beverly has enjoyed a distinguished career across theatre, television and music. Her appointment reflects Wolverhampton Grand Theatre's ongoing commitment to celebrating excellence in the performing arts while strengthening its community and charitable outreach." Karen Smallwood, CEO of Wolverhampton Grand Theatre, said, "We're absolutely thrilled to welcome Beverly Knight as our first ever patron. Beverly's exceptional contribution to British theatre and her deep passion for Wolverhampton makes her the perfect ambassador for everything we stand for. Her passion for performance and her belief in the transformative power of the arts will inspire future generations and help us to reach even more people through our charitable work."
Two new community trees have been unveiled in the gardens of Hope House Children's Hospices to celebrate 30 years since the charity first opened its doors. The specially designed steel trees have been installed at Hope House in Oswestry and at Teague Abbeyth in Conwy as a lasting tribute to the thousands of families and supporters who have been part of the charity's journey. Hope House opened in Oswestry in 1995 to provide vital care for local children with life-threatening conditions and their families. Teague Abbeyth followed in 2004 and celebrated its 20th anniversary last year. Since opening, Hope House has grown from being the 10th children's hospice in the world to supporting more than 750 families each year, all at no cost to them. Each tree features up to 250 leaves that supporters can sponsor and have engraved with a personal message. Laura Ellis Bartlett from the charity's fundraising team said, "The bespoke trees are being created in steel by Red Dragon Metal Art and will be sited in the gardens at Teague Abbeyth and Hope House for everyone to see. It's a beautiful way for you to become part of our future, as well as our past. To sponsor a leaf, visit hopehouse.org.uk.
A man has been ordered to pay more than £2,000 after being caught using a fake blue badge to park in a disabled bay in Shrewsbury. Bruce Fielding from London was charged with the misuse of a blue badge in March of this year. Shropshire Council said the offence occurred when Fielding parked his vehicle in a disabled bay on St Mary Street, Shrewsbury, displaying a blue badge on the dashboard. A civil enforcement officer noticed irregularities with the badge. It appeared to be a copy, and the identification number indicated it had been issued to a woman born in 1922. When Fielding returned to his car, no such person was present. When asked to hand over the badge for inspection, he refused and drove away. Further inquiries confirmed that the badge was a counterfeit copy of a genuine expired badge, with the expiry date altered to make it appear valid. A Telford's magistrate's court, Fielding, was fined £206 and ordered to pay a £122 victim surcharge and £1,693 in costs, a total of over £2,000. Mr. Fielding did not attend court but pleaded guilty by post. Grant Tunnedy, Trading Standards and Parking Enforcement Team Manager with Shropshire Council, said, "Shropshire Council provides on-street parking concessions for blue badge holders to help people with disabilities park closer to their destination, allowing them to remain mobile and independent. Inappropriate use of these parking spaces can result in badge holders missing medical appointments, not being able to get shopping, or being unable to park for work. Those who abuse the blue badge system deny vital parking spaces to people who need them the most."
Track 3. Recently, my wife and I looked after two of our grandchildren for the weekend as their parents enjoyed a well-earned break. A reasonable percentage of our weekend was spent on the touchline at both hockey and rugby matches. We were most impressed by the quality of the bacon baps served at the Bridge North Rugby Club's junior headquarters. I don't suppose that Dave Gregory has a bacon bap after preparing his sports report, but you never know. Over to you, Dave.
Hello, everybody. Well, now, both Shrewsbury Town and AFC Telford United were involved in FA Cup action in their first round proper last weekend, the 1st and 2nd of November, and experienced mixed fortunes. Well, Wolves' nightmare season in the Premier League got worse and resulted in the sacking of manager Vitorio Pereira. Defeat at Sutton United, bottom of the National League, last Saturday ended AFC Telford United's FA Cup campaign for this season. Telford showed lots of character, but didn't quite do enough to beat their full-time opponents. Sutton made the better start, but gradually Telford started to dictate play, despite being without their two regular central defenders. The Bucks created some chances, but the home side broke away to take the lead in the 40th minute. Telford responded, but couldn't find the net. Just after the break, Sutton were 2-0 up, but Telford substitute Ricardo Dinanga headed home in the 64th minute. The game was now in the balance, but while Telford showed energy and endeavour, they couldn't outwit the opposition, so 2-1 to Sutton was the final score. And on Tuesday evening of this week, Telford returned to league action in the National League North, entertaining Merthyr Tydfil Town. Shrewsbury Town produced a professional display last Sunday to avoid an FA Cup upset at National League North promotion contenders South Shields in Northumberland. The home side made the brighter start, putting Town under pressure. A foul in the South Shields penalty area in the 23rd minute resulted in Anthony Scully coolly scoring from the penalty spot, a goal that gave Town a confidence boost. 11 minutes later, Scully scored a second from close range. In the 44th minute, Thomas Sang made it 3-0 to Shrewsbury with a neat finish. After a quiet opening to the second half, South Shields pulled a goal back in the 67th minute. To their credit, Town then quelled any pressure from their opponents and were close to adding to the lead on a couple of occasions. A controlled display from Town thoroughly earned a place in round two. So 3-1 was the final score, and in round two we now have the draw, and would you believe it, Shrewsbury had drawn away to Sutton United, who recently beat Telford, as we've just been hearing. And of course, had the game gone the other way at Sutton, we'd have had a Shropshire derby, wouldn't we, in the FA Cup round two. But it's not to be. Shrewsbury will travel to Sutton in South London, or certainly in Kent near South London, in early December. Despite a close 3-4 scoreline at home to Chelsea in the Carabao Cup in midweek, when Wolves visited fourth bottom Fulham last Saturday, a disastrous display saw them beaten 3-0. Their performance lacked any energy, urgency or quality, and their first half team selection caused some surprises. Fulham scored in the 9th minute, following a Wolves mistake. Wolves' response looked tired and uninspired and lacked any end result. Their defender Agbadou was sent off in the first half, and in the second half, Wolves never really looked like causing Fulham any problems. Fulham scored again in the 62nd and 75th minutes, so 3-0 to Fulham was the final score, and now Wolves have become the first club in top-flight history to fail to win any of their opening 10 matches in two consecutive seasons. Next weekend, they're back in south-west London, away to Chelsea, so goodness me, what'll happen, we'll have to wait and see. Now to local junior soccer, and in the Midlands Football League Division 1, AFC Bridge North were held to a 1-1 draw at home to 9th-placed AFC North Kilworth and Bridgnorth the 7th. And when Shifnal Town beat Mossley 3-1 at home on Saturday 25th of October, they climbed to 3rd place in the Northern 1 West League, while Ludlow Town sat in 11th spot in the Hellenic League Division 1, serving up a goalless stalemate at home to high-flying Cheltenham Saracens. Now to women's soccer, and manager Daryl Tidman Poole has called on Shrewsbury Town ladies to become more ruthless, despite watching them put 5 goals past Alvechurch away from home on Sunday 26th of October. Zoe Child scored twice as Shrewsbury moved up to 4th in the West Midlands League Premier Division. Shifnal Town remained the team to catch after extending their perfect record to 5 wins from 5 with a 3-1 home win over Burton Albion. Taylor Davies struck twice for Shifnal in that victory. In Division 1 North, 2 goals each for Hope Dunn and Abby Norrie saw AFC Telford United take the glory in the derby match at Telford Town. Town scored first, but Dunn and Norrie's goals gave United a 4-1 lead before a late Town goal made the final score 4-2. Bottom of the table, Whitchurch Alport shipped 7 goals at home to Lichfield City, and in round 1 of the Shropshire Women's League Cup, Orr Brighton caused the shock of the day when they hammered league leaders Worthing Juniors 5-0 to progress to the second round. Now on to other sports, and Shropshire cyclist Alison Salthouse has defied the odds to become a world champion at the age of 66. The inspirational athlete from Shawbirch, Telford, took part in the World Masters Track Championship at the Stade Velodrome in Roubaix, France, where she took on riders from across the globe in the ladies' 65-69 age category. Taking a bronze medal in the individual pursuit race, Alison then qualified for the gold medal ride-off in the sprint race. In the best-of-three race, she outwitted and outsprinted her opponent to win the first two rides, as she was crowned a world champion, so very well done to her. 20-year-old St George's bowler Joe Killen finished the 2025 summer season in winning style, pocketing £300 by coming on top of the pile in the Allscott Heath Open on the Village Club's artificial green. Joe beat county teammate Scott Harris of St John Bailey Club 21-15 in the final on Saturday 25th of October. And that banished memories of Tom's losing in the final of the Midlands Masters tournament recently. And while we're on the subject of bowling success, 4 of the Shropshire Premier League's finest have won a £1,000 open bowls competition, thanks to a wonder strike by Castlefield's maestro Callum Raitt. Stuart Rutter and Scott Harris of Sir John Bailey Club, and County No. 1 Callum Raitt and his Castlefield's teammate Andy Armstrong qualified for the finals of the Windmill Fours near Rugeley, Staffordshire. In the singles final, Raitt was the only Shropshire winner by a score of 21-8, and in the doubles match, Rutter and Harris won their match 21-10, but Raitt and Armstrong were staring at defeat at 20-20. But in the very last bowl, Callum Raitt won the point, striking off an opponent's bowl to ensure that the four-man title went to the Shropshire Quartet. Now to rugby, and on Saturday 25th of October, Newport hit the comeback trail to secure a dramatic victory and stay hot on the heels of the leaders in Regional 1 Midlands. In the clash at Banbury, playing into the wind in the first half, Newport found themselves trailing 14-0 at the break. Playing much better in the second half, Newport battled back, and a last-gasp penalty gave them a close 20-19 away victory, and Newport are third in the league table. In the same league, Bridgnorth came up just short, as they were edged out in yet another tight encounter. In a seesaw match, Bridgnorth actually missed a penalty with the last kick of the game, and thus they went down 34-33, but I'm not sure who were their opponents. However, Bridgnorth, I am sure, were 8th in the table after that game. And in Regional 2 Midlands West, Ludlow go into the second break of the season with a hard-fought 30-22 home victory over Hereford behind them, and Ludlow are in second place. So on that happy note, that's all the sports news for this week, so thank you for listening, and bye-bye. Until next time.
Track 4. Whether your interest is in alternative Christmas dinners, a rescue rabbit seeking a new home, or beekeeping prisoners, Chris and Roy have something for everyone in this last visit to the newsroom for this issue.
Health staff in Shropshire are buzzing about the success of a project that had seen prisoners in the county learning all about bees. One of the 25 jars of honey produced by the project was presented to Princess Anne, the Princess Royal, during a visit to HMP Stoke Heath near Market Drayden in the summer. Members of staff at Shropshire Community National Health Service Trust, employees at HMP Stoke Heath, and an organisation called Food Behind Bars were trained by Shropshire Beekeeping Society. The idea was to create a bespoke 12-month project to support prisoners, focusing on individuals who were struggling with autism, ADHD, mental health, and substance misuse issues. A spokesperson for Shropshire.com said this has been a transformational journey over the last 12 months for those involved in the programme. We take care for granted, but when a person loses part of their freedom, being outdoors can feel like a luxury. The project, which also involves learning how to grow food from scratch, came under the umbrella of social prescribing, with an aim to help prisoners learn how to take more responsibility for their own health and well-being, rather than just relying on the medical model. A Shropshire.com spokesperson said the vision was to learn how to grow food from seed, how to cook from scratch, and then to take these skills back to their families. The high cost of living was discussed as a concern for some individuals, and many didn't realise how much food can be grown at a relatively small cost. One of their memories was remembering favourite family recipes from childhood, which invoked positive experiences. The beekeeping element came in as many were conscious of the environment and the important part that bees play in the ecosystem, a spokesperson said. It was offered on a four-week basis for small groups of 4 to 6 men. An underused yard was transformed into an outdoor kitchen gardening space where prisoners built 6 raised beds. It is used for sensory walks and experiences for small groups of men. A Shropshire.com spokesperson said the men have fed back that this has helped to calm when stressed and they have appreciated being in nature. It has been really helpful for those who are neurodivergent by having a quieter space to rebalance. Staff have spoken about a prisoner so happy at mixing with others that he couldn't stop smiling for the whole 4 weeks, which was amazing to see. Another participant that has left intended to join this local beekeeping society as a way to become more involved with his community on release. The garden staff at HMP Stoke Heath made sure that the 2 hives delivered in July 2024 were checked on regularly, making sure that the queen was still present and she was still producing eggs. The initial part of the project ended in July 2025 and was taken over by the prison garden staff in August 2025. Prisoners who have jobs in the garden can be involved. Before the end of the 12-month project, some 25 jars of solid honey were harvested, with the experts saying that most of the pollen had come from the rapeseed in the surrounding fields. It is hoped that future harvests will be sold to help fund the upkeep of the beehives so that it can remain a sustainable project.
new invaluable hub for veterans and serving military personnel has officially opened in Telford in honour of a former councillor who served in the army for decades. The Christopher Turley Armed Forces Community Hub, located in Dorley, has officially opened. Named in honour of Chris Turley, who passed away in August last year, the new centre will provide vital support and advice for veterans, serving personnel and their families, helping them access specialist services, welfare support and a host of practical guidance. Chris served for 22 years in the HM Armed Forces until 1994, before continuing his career in an operational role at the Royal Air Force Museum, Cosford, until his retirement in 2010. He later dedicated more than a decade to public service, representing the Nedge Ward as a borough councillor from 2011 to 2024. He also served on Great Dorley Council and as a parish councillor for Hollinswood, Randley and Sturchley and Brookside. Through his role as chair of the Armed Forces Community Covenant, Chris was committed to supporting serving personnel, veterans and their families across Telford and Wrekin. Chris's son, Sergeant Major Andy Turley, officially cut the ribbon to open the hub in his father's honour. He said, "They are a massive support. We have a huge veterans community now. If someone has come back and fallen on hard times, whether that be mental health issues, homelessness, struggling financially or to get a job, a hub like this can be a one-stop shop where they can come and get help, information, guidance and directions to get their lives back on track." Asked what it means for the hub to be named in his father's memory, his other son, Chris, said, "It's fantastic. I never expected it. They did tell me after he passed away that they were planning something special because of how he had been perceived in the community. It's brilliant. It's somewhere I can pop into as well and see my dad's name there, his picture on the wall, and be proud that he has given back to his community and that they have given something back to remember him by. It's a great honour." Telford MP Sean Davis attended the hub opening and paid tribute to Chris and praised the facility as a lasting legacy. Councillor Chris Turley dedicated his life to service, he said, whether through his work in local government, his quiet acts of kindness, his unwavering support for those who have served in uniform. He was the best of us. Now this physical hub stands as a living tribute to Chris, where veterans can find companionship, understanding and the practical support they deserve. It is a space built on respect and community. Chris's memory will live on in every cup of tea and in every veteran who finds hope and help here. This hub is a promise that we will continue to care for those who have given so much for our country, just as Chris always did.
The best and worst places to live in Shropshire have been ranked by AI, Chatbot and ChatGPT. Shrewsbury finds itself top of the pile as the most coveted Shropshire location. However, two of its suburbs were rated as the worst places to live. Giving its verdict on the town of Flowers being the best place to live, the AI chatbot said that Shrewsbury was beautiful, historic architecture, good amenities, independent shops, and strong schooling options, and offers a mix of town and countryside. It says Shrewsbury is best for families wanting good schools and amenities, couples who like having independent shops, people who want some countryside, but still somewhere lively. However, Halscott and Monkmore came in for criticism from ChatGPT. It said Halscott is identified in the 2015 Index of Multiple Deprivation as the only lower super output area in Shropshire, falling within the 10% most deprived in England. Among its challenges, high worklessness, lower access to services, concentrated deprivation. ChatGPT also said Monkmore is a relatively deprived area, advising people who are considering moving there to check schools, transport and local amenities. The south of Oswestry was also given a harsh rap by AI, with the software saying, "The castle ward of Oswestry shows up in earlier reports as one of the most deprived SOAs in Shropshire." The ChatGPT added, "Deprivation doesn't always correlate with high crime in rural Shropshire in the same way as major cities. For example, although some areas have higher crime rates, they might still be safer than urban equivalents. Other areas of the county to score high with AI included Ludlow and Bishop's Castle. Ludlow was said to be a historic market town in the Shropshire Hills, highlighted for its natural environment and well-being aspects. In Telford, ChatGPT ranks Priorslee, Shoreburch and Wellington as the best places to live. Priorslee is described as the place to live in the town, with good links to the M54 as well as good housing and amenities. Shoreburch is described as a tranquil residential area, while Wellington received praise for its character and proximity to the countryside. Woodside, Brookside, Madeley and Sutton Hill were rated as the worst places in the town. The key concerns in Woodside were described as low home ownership, high unemployment and a high proportion of single-parent households. Deprivation was cited as a problem in Brookside, Madeley and Sutton Hill.
Boysy the Bunny is hopping to find a new owner after a run of bad luck. Staff and volunteers at RSPCA Gonsall Farm Animal Centre near Shrewsbury are hoping that Boysy's luck will be on the turn this Adoptober. Named after the Only Fools and Horses character, he arrived at the Dorrington Centre back in July and he's been looking for his new home since the start of September. His appeal comes during the RSPCA's month-long Adoptober rehoming campaign, which aims to increase adoption rates across England and Wales. The drive celebrates the benefits of rescue pets, highlights the many animals that are waiting to find their perfect forever match, and dispels myths about rescuing and pet rehoming. It also comes as rehoming centres across England and Wales are at full capacity, with pets either waiting to be adopted or being assessed for adoption, leaving countless dogs, cats and other animals still in emergency boarding waiting for a place at a rehoming centre. Kennel Cattery Supervisor Alice Batcher-Reynolds said Boysy's had a tough time after his beloved partner died and he's now keen to be rehomed with a new Marlene. He sadly lost his partner due to severe ill health and he really struggled with human contact after that, said Alice. However, the team has been working hard to build his confidence again, and now he will happily be around people. He prefers us to sit with him so he can explore us, climbing on laps and enjoying tasty treats. He would be best suited to an experienced rabbit owner who understands he will need time and patience to learn to trust them, but it will be well worth it. Boysy also could really do with a female bun to partner up with and become best of friends, just like Mr. and Mrs. Boysy in Only Fools and Horses. Getting a pet brings a lot of joy, but before committing, it's important to understand the costs. The RSPCA Pet Cost Calculator on its website can help you prepare for this. It's also important to consider pet insurance to protect against unexpected costs. More information about cats and other animals available for adoption can be found on the RSPCA's Find a Pet webpage.
Younger British adults are forsaking the traditional Christmas dinner, with almost a fifth saying they will be serving up the likes of curry, pasta or pizza instead this year. Some 17% of those aged 25 to 34 are turning away from the traditional turkey and all the trimmings in favour of mixing things up with non-traditional fare, according to Tesco's annual Christmas Trends report, based on a survey and sales figures. Just 52% of adults of all ages plan to serve turkey this Christmas, with 23% opting for chicken, 20% turning to beef, and 21% preparing a plant-based menu. While pigs in blankets is the best-loved trimming among all adults, only 22% of those aged 25 to 34 would say the same, preferring rice or even chips. Nearly three-quarters of people expect they will or may host at some point over the Christmas period, including casual family-style meals, formal sit-down meals and drinks and nibbles. Cheese is the favoured party food, followed by crisps and dips, while 28% of people plan to drink less alcohol this Christmas, and 12% do not plan to drink alcohol at all. The average table size for Christmas in the UK will be 8 people, while hosts in Northern Ireland will stretch to 11 people, the survey suggests. The most stressful moments come when cooking the main meal, washing up afterwards, and cleaning the house beforehand. Some 70% of people will put up an artificial Christmas tree this year, while 15% will have 3 or more trees.
Track 5. This is the start of the second feature section of this issue, with a variety of items chosen from our file store, another of the facilities at ESTN to have been established by Chris Pitchford. Last week, Robert Green brought us the first part of his interview with the team at Cooan Wildlife Rescue in Much Wenlock. Like Robert, I had need of their services a couple of years ago when we found a hedgehog in a recessed area at the bottom of some steps at our garden. It was in the middle of the day, when hedgehogs should be hidden away. After taking advice, I took the creature to Cooan, who checked that it wasn't a pregnant female. It turns out that it was a well-nourished male who was safely released into the wild after a few days' observation in the quarantine. It's a bit odd to get enthusiastic about finding poo in your garden, but when it's hedgehog poo, I feel glad that we're providing a suitable habitat. Maybe it's our Cooan hedgehog or one of his friends or relations. Here's Robert with the second part of his visit to the Wildlife Rescue Centre.
What's the most unusual creature you've had brought in here?
We're always surprised when we have any kind of seabird brought in, because obviously Shropshire is a landlocked county. But last year we had several seabirds brought in that had been blown badly off course by the storms that we had. So we actually had 4 Manx shearwater, which is quite a rare and quirky seabird, brought in. We had at least 1 gannet brought in. So we're always surprised when we get seabirds. But we never know what's going to come in. We had a bird brought in on Friday and had us all reaching for our identification apps on our phones because we weren't quite sure what it was, and it was a meadow pipit. But you never know what's going to turn up on the doorstep. Occasionally, we have animals or birds brought in that aren't wildlife at all, that the public find and assume are wildlife, and it turns out to be an escaped pet of some kind. All range of species, mammals, birds, amphibians, reptiles, you name it. Anything can turn up.
And what sort of numbers are we talking about, say, a month?
Well, I can tell you that last year, in 2024, we admitted almost 6,500 creatures over the year. This year, we're already nudging up to 5,000, so I think we will exceed that number. Our busiest months are end of April, beginning of May, through to October. Then our admission numbers really explode. That's the season when everything is breeding, everything is having babies, and lots of those babies end up here. So May through to October is an absolutely manic season. And for that reason, we employ extra staff for the summer months. Our opening hours are very long. We open at 7 o'clock in the morning and we shut at 10 o'clock at night. And the work between those hours is absolutely non-stop. So we have more staff for those months. In the winter months, we're much, much quieter. We still have admissions, but far, far fewer. So from end of October, beginning of November through till April, we're much quieter and we go back to a core of permanent staff then. Admissions for the last few years have risen every year.
Are you all volunteers here or do you have paid staff?
No, we have a small team of core staff. We have a hospital manager and assistant manager, and then about 5 permanent staff working hands-on with the animals. We have an office manager. We have a fundraising manager, community fundraising manager. We have me, so I supervise and manage all the people here who aren't paid, so all the volunteers and also other students. We have a lot of students that come to us either on work experience or as part of their course. Increasingly, we're getting vet students apply to us for placement because they don't get to learn a lot about wildlife while they're at vet school, but it's obviously very important that they know about wildlife. They have the same duty of care to wildlife as they do to domestic and farm animals. Core team of paid staff, and then they're supported by a large band of volunteers who do all kinds of different roles.
And you talked about veterinary surgeons. You presumably have a hospital here where you take your admissions. Mm-hmm. Do you have veterinary surgeons?
We do. We don't have a vet here full time, but it is a requirement of any animal rehabilitation facility that you have the services of a vet attached to you. So we have a fantastic vet called Chris, who actually works at Seven Edge Vets in Bridgnorth. He has his own room here. He's not here all the time, but he's on call and comes to visit us this time of year, routinely, probably 2 or 3 times a week, far less in the winter. And he can do things that we can't do. We can do a lot of things. We can assess, we can medicate, we can give physiotherapy. He's got extra facilities, so he's got the ability to give animals or birds a general anaesthetic, which we haven't in his room. So if, for example, we had an adult badger or an adult fox admitted, there's no way that we would be able to examine that animal properly without it being given a general anaesthetic, or we would be likely to come off worse than the animal. So he can do that for us. And he's obviously got that underlying anatomy knowledge, physiology knowledge that he's had at vet school, so he can give us advice on courses of treatment, on the nature of injuries. He can stitch under general anaesthetic, which obviously we can't. He can do things like remove fishing hooks from inside swans' throats under general anaesthetic. So he's very important, but we've got a lovely, respectful relationship with him. We obviously respect his knowledge and advice, but equally he respects that we've got years and years and years of knowledge and experience of dealing just with wildlife, which he hasn't. So it's a very good professional dialogue that goes on between us and Chris.
So, Deb, you were saying this is not a forever home. So what happens eventually?
It's not. No, we are a wildlife rescue. We're not a sanctuary. No animal or bird stays here forever. When Megan started off the charity all those years ago, the ethos was born then that we believe very, very strongly that wildlife belongs in the wild. We know it that it's not happy behind bars. We know that from experience, because if you give any animal or bird a chink of freedom, you know, if we leave a cage open in one of the rooms for a second too long, that bird or animal will try to get out. There's no way that they belong behind bars. They can't display all the freedoms that they're entitled to if they're behind bars. They can't reproduce. They can't forage or hunt in the way that they would do in the wild. So our ultimate aim is to rehabilitate and get that animal or bird back to the wild. If for any reason we cannot get a bird or an animal back to the stage where it would be able to be released back into the wild and thrive in the wild, live happily, and it's actually illegal for us to release anything that can't thrive, then we do put that animal or bird to sleep.
Well, thank you, Deb, very much for talking about and showing me what you do. You do an absolutely splendid job, so do carry on.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Track 6. From time to time, there's an item in the local newspaper that's not really news, but is of general interest and belongs in part 2 rather than in the bulletins in part 1. Did you know there was a hobgoblin at Lawley Gate Well in Telford? Here, with more about the hobgoblin, the restoration of the well and the Cinderloo Uprising, is an item by Robert Smith in the Telford Journal, read by Terry Frost.
You find the strangest of things when you follow a dog's nose. I was looking after a guest of the four-legged kind over the weekend, and that meant even more walking than usual. If dogs did TripAdvisor, I would like to think I would earn 5 stars. So it was that my canine companion and I wound up on a footpath not far from my door, face to face with a hobgoblin, and not the kind you might see discarded in the grass after a heavy weekend. The sculptured creature guards a waist-high shaft by the side of the path, the Lawley Gate well. The well was first used around the 1820s and was positioned opposite a toll house, but had been forgotten and faded into the undergrowth in the intervening 200 years. That was until a group of local history buffs cleaned up the area before metalworking experts Paul Ashmore and Andrew Naylor made this unforgettable cover featuring our pointy-hatted friend. Of course, half the joy with finds like these is the threads of local history they reveal to you, ripe for the pulling. I already knew a little about the well, thanks to local historian Peter Jackson, who was instrumental in the project to restore the well, but the name chosen for this horsey goblin, Topolin, is a nod to a specific seismic event in East Shropshire history, the Cynderloo Uprising. The Battle of Cynderloo in February of 1821 shook the area that is modern-day Telford, with downtrodden miners uniting against unfair pay and being met with military resistance. Two workers were killed, a third was later hanged, and eight were imprisoned. Around 3,000 miners, women and children marched on the cinder hills at Old Park, now the Forge Retail Park, in protest at sudden pay cuts of sixpence. They were met by the Shropshire Yeomanry and told to disperse, but refused to back down, and violence broke out. Telford might be a new town, but that doesn't mean it has no history. You can learn plenty more about the uprising at cynderloo.com.
Track 7. A lady called Sophie Jones has given her face, name and story to the Lingan Davis Sunflower Appeal. The charity is aiming to raise £5 million to establish a second chemotherapy centre in the county, as you'll hear in this piece from the Shropshire Magazine. It's read by Suzanne Lawler.
Lingan Davis Cancer Support has launched its biggest appeal to date, to deliver the Lingan Davis Cancer Centre at the Princess Royal Hospital in Telford, doubling the capacity for chemotherapy across the region. The 5 million sunflower appeal launched this summer to grow cancer provision for those impacted throughout Shropshire, Telford and Wrekin and Mid Wales. Sophie Jones, 30, from Whittington, is one of those people currently going through cancer treatment locally. The primary school teacher had big plans for 2025, including celebrating her 30th birthday in style, marrying her longtime partner, and a long list of travel plans. But a diagnosis of low-grade serous ovarian cancer in 2024, following years of ongoing health concerns and being told she was too young for cancer, meant Sophie and partner Ewan's plans had to be put on hold. Sophie has bravely given her face, name and story to the charity's Sunflower Appeal to help further its life-saving fundraising and boost cancer awareness amongst younger people. Looking back, Sophie, who originally hails from Llansanfraid, thinks her cancer journey actually began many years ago when she was just 23. After years of enduring symptoms such as water infections, passing blood and bloating, Sophie opted to have a private consultation with a consultant urologist. A CT scan revealed a large mass growing on her left fallopian tube. A series of biopsies brought her to a diagnosis, and so her treatment began. "I was always going back and forth to the doctors with water infections. They give me antibiotics, which would clear it up, and then 3 months later I'd have another water infection. I'd had various tests that all came back normal, but I just feel really dirty, like something was wrong with me. I would go to the toilet, wipe, and blood would be on the paper. My mum always told me that if that happened, it was really bad, so I went to the doctors who suggested it was a skin tag or hemorrhoid. They sent me for a colonoscopy, which also came back fine. I then raised the question as to whether it could be ovarian cancer, but at 24 years old, I was told I was too young. And then in 2024, I started urinating blood. And the only way I can describe it is that I couldn't stop pushing. I also started to bloat. People would tell me I didn't look bloated, but I know my body and what's normal for me. After making the decision to go private, a CT scan revealed a large mass. Thank God they did that scan, because that's when they found a mass on my left side. I was then sent to gynaecology, requesting immediate response, which is when I was sent for the emergency MRI to check if it was cancer. With no sign of malignancy, Sophie was sent back to the NHS at Royal Shrewsbury Hospital, with the expectation that she would have her left fallopian tube removed. I was teaching forest school when I got a call saying the mass on my left side had grown. They wanted to get me in sooner rather than later, so I had a laparoscopy operation booked for December the 8th. Unfortunately, I came out of that surgery with a request from the doctor to speak to me. The surgeon explained that they were unable to perform the operation as Sophie's fallopian tube, ovary and bowel were all stuck together. They also mentioned they'd taken some biopsies. I got upset and started crying, as I had a really exciting 2025 planned and I didn't want another operation. I had too much going on. I was turning 30, celebrating my hen do and marrying my best friend. I was too distracted to ask what the biopsies were for. On December the 23rd, I had a letter to say I had an appointment a week later at gynaecology oncology at Royal Shrewsbury Hospital. I'd been to the clinic there before, so I wasn't too concerned. I was expecting to hear that I had endometriosis. The nurse came out and asked if I had anyone with me, but even that didn't trigger any alarm bells. Then the doctor started to say he was sorry, and I remember thinking, oh no, before the panic started. He told me it was cancer, and I just started hyperventilating. I remember thinking, I'm too young for this. It isn't supposed to happen to me. I asked them what happens next, and they broke the news that I was going to have all my reproductive organs removed, and I'd never have children. I then asked if I was going to die, and he said, I don't know. I hoped to hear we'd caught it early, but I didn't. That conversation was horrendous. Following the scan results, Sophie was sent to Birmingham at the end of January for specialist treatment, as her cancer was complex and had spread through her abdomen. I was told lots of young women get misdiagnosed and instead have borderline cancer, which is only on the verge of being malignant. Of course, I held on to any form of hope, as if that was the case for me, I might be able to keep my ovaries and have children. I left my appointment feeling hopeful, but by the time I got to the car park, I had a call from my nurse and was asked to come back in. They just received copies of my scans and confirmed that it was definitely cancer. I felt like I'd got diagnosed twice. They booked me in for surgery as soon as they could. The following Monday, Sophie went in for her major abdominal surgery, including a hysterectomy, which would save her life but leave her infertile. After 9.5 hours, she came out of surgery without any visible signs of cancer, but with the dream she once had shattered. As a way of processing her diagnosis and to help raise vital awareness of her cancer, Sophie created an Instagram page dedicated to sharing her experiences. I decided to start sharing through the Instagram page to raise awareness of low-grade serous ovarian cancer, because so little is known about it. Since I posted about my experiences, people have messaged me saying that after reading my post and seeking medical advice, they found out they have endometriosis or another rare condition. I've never ignored my symptoms and want to encourage others to listen to what their body is telling them. After she'd recovered from surgery, Sophie started chemotherapy treatment at the Lyngon Davis Cancer Centre in April, a week after her 30th birthday. Reflecting on her chemotherapy treatment, Sophie said she was surprised at first by what it was like. I didn't feel like I was having chemotherapy, which feels weird to say. At first I was a bit taken aback seeing everyone with drips, but everyone was sitting in chairs rather than lying in beds, which is what I'd expected from films. It's busy, loud and weirdly happy, like going for coffee with friends. It's quite a sociable place. Nobody will understand unless they've been through it. Even the nurses can't fully understand. I don't want to play it down because it's a serious thing, but I felt like I was chilling with friends. As Sophie was so enthusiastic about raising awareness of cancer, particularly cancer in young people, she was approached by Lincoln Davis to be the face of its £5 million sunflower appeal, to deliver a Lincoln Davis Cancer Centre in Telford's Prince's Royal Hospital by 2029, doubling chemotherapy capacity in the region. When I was having my chemotherapy, I spoke to lots of people from Telford. After chemotherapy, you don't want to be travelling ages as you're exhausted. For me, it was an 8-hour day and that was draining. The fact that chemotherapy capacity is doubling is so important as it means people can have chemotherapy sooner and closer to home. Cancer isn't going anywhere, and we all know that time is of the essence. So this development will help speed up the whole process for lots of people. Shropshire is a massive place, so the fact that people have to travel all the way to Shrewsbury, even from places like Ludlow, is crazy. Everyone needs to support this appeal, as if there's another cancer centre in the region, it will free up capacity in Shrewsbury. People need to back this appeal and do as much as they can, because unfortunately, we're all only one phone call away from your life changing. As part of the Lincoln Davis Wellbeing Programme, EL Beauty in Telford delivers free holistic treatments for people in the region living with and beyond cancer. Sophie said, "I contacted EL Beauty for microneedling, but it was too soon after my treatment, so I was offered a massage instead." Emma is such a beautiful person, so down to earth and genuine. The fact that it's free to access thanks to Lincoln Davis funding is amazing. Cancer changes whole lives, so it costs a lot of money, and none of it feels like a choice. Having a free service to help my body recover and for cosmetic reasons was life-changing. Since my diagnosis, I've become funny about the products I put on my skin. But because Emma has specialised in working with chemotherapy patients, I knew I was in safe hands. You can trust her. Now she's finished her chemotherapy treatment, Sophie is looking ahead to the future. "I just want to get on with my life, but I am scared. I want to forget everything and be normal, but I'm never going to be. At the very least, I just need some sense of normality. I'm going to be hosting an event this month to raise money for the appeal because it's just so important. In November, I'm also going to be talking about my experiences at a medical conference in Birmingham." Alongside hosting and attending events, Sophie continues to document her experiences on Instagram. You can follow her at stillsassy with C. To find out more about Lincoln Davis Cancer Support and how you can support its £5 million sunflower appeal, visit lincolndavis.co.uk/sunflower-appeal or email hello@lincolndavis.co.uk.
Track 8. TNF soundings share items from the Wildlife Sound Recording Society. The recordings are really evocative, even though I've never heard a lion growling in the wild or the sound of vultures consuming the meat off a carcass. Clive Davis introduces Chris Watson, who's travelled the world with his recording equipment, though still gets great pleasure from the sounds nearer to home. And yes, there are more hedgehogs.
TNF Soundings. Features from across the UK.
Hello, it's Clive Davis from the Wildlife Sound Recording Society. This month's recording is by our recently retired president, Chris Watson. Chris, who has recorded many programmes for the BBC, introduces and describes recordings that he has made around the world.
Over the past 40 years, I've had the great privilege of recording wildlife sounds on all seven continents. And in the oceans between both poles. Back at home, and after a break, I'm always interested to hear what's been going on in our suburban back garden. I've spent a lot of time recording in the tropics, but I really do relish the four seasons here at 55 degrees north. Several summers ago, I came home one evening, and under some fearsome-looking brambles beneath a hawthorn bush, I heard this. I hung a mic about a metre overhead and caught a glimpse of two hedgehogs nose to nose. Most likely, this was a pair with the male soliciting the female. We've good numbers of pipistrelle bats in the area and a summer roost in the eaves. Here's one group eager to get out hunting as soon as the daylight fades. Using an audio moth at a high sample rate, I was delighted to record these pipistrelle echolocation signals and contact calls, here slowed down 8 times as the bats hawked up and down the garden. Our back garden has also served as a studio for experimenting with recording techniques. That vulture shriek, recorded in the Masai Mara, was obtained as a result of trying out a pair of personal mics in a turkey carcass after it had served several Christmas meals. When the starlings descended upon it in Newcastle-upon-Tyne, it framed the ideal close perspective I was seeking when back out in Africa. Urban foxes are doing fairly well in our neighbourhood, and on winter nights, the vixens sometimes announce their visits from the path at the end of the garden. It's always a delight that blackbirds and robins are with us throughout the seasons, friends that are always there on my return. The autumn song battles of robins. And the evening competitions as blackbirds roost. As January concludes and territories are fought over, I eagerly anticipate the first song phrases of spring. And it usually comes from one of the branches in the old apple tree. This blackbird was singing out of the chilled, pre-dawn darkness. It's one of the most spirited and passionate songs I have ever heard on any continent. And it's right here on my doorstep.
TNF Soundings.
Track 9. What's in a name? I don't know about you, but I had one or two nicknames during my childhood. None of them really stuck, though friends who've known me for many years shortened my first name to Cy. Local Shropshire poet Steve Harrison accidentally tried out a different first name once whilst on holiday. He became Richard for a while.
I was not expecting the words of W.B. Yeats to go with afternoon tea and cakes on patterned plates on a Saigon rooftop restaurant. I'd waved goodbye to our venture tour pals 3 days before. They'll be putting passports and travel plugs into familiar drawers, retailing the tales of last month's buddies, quickly bonding, sharing spliffs, swapping hoodies, giving advice on buying silver rings and peeing on each other's jellyfish stings. And commenting on handmade silk dresses, that's really fab. And swapping seat tickets, she confesses, to avoid those two mad lads on the Hanoi Saigon Express, no less. For 2 weeks, they'd call me Richard, as the tour guide had. A name she copied from a flight list when we first arrived. A name I never used, but tried it for a while, and how were they to know? And the hotel's American singer rehearsing on that same rooftop for his evening show. Rehearsed a bit of Frank Sinatra and Louis Armstrong, and then practising the ad-libs for his set, looked me in the eye and declared, "Remember, sir, there are no strangers here, just friends we haven't met yet." I was not expecting the words of W.B. Yeats to go with afternoon tea on patterned plates on a Saigon rooftop restaurant.
Track 10. Last week, I was sitting waiting for my appointment at Boots Opticians in Shrewsbury. On the wall next to me was a poster advertising Ray-Ban Meta smart glasses. Artificial intelligence is very much the thing of the moment, with articles singing the praises of ChatGPT or warning of doom and gloom as the arts are going to be decimated or the machines are going to take over the world. There must be a middle ground somewhere, and maybe it's a pair of glasses that'll read the menu for you or help you to get around. Whether we're excited about its potential or apprehensive about the downsides, the technology is becoming more mainstream by the day. Here's Mary Buckley in an item about smart glasses from TNF Soundings.
TNF Soundings. Features from across the UK.
Hello, I'm Mary Buckley, and this article called Smart Glasses, Seeing is Believing, was written by Lindsay. The first thing that comes to mind when hearing the term smart glasses is a pair of spectacles with a fancy modern frame to look fashionable. However, there are two angles to that these days, as looking smart has now been combined with clever smart in the form of artificial intelligence. Several companies are now marketing reasonably affordable smart glasses, costing from around £300 to £500. This puts them in the same price range as a high-quality mid-range smartphone. Of course, a standard smartphone can take photographs, speak, text, and assist with information searches. So what about the AI smart glasses? Well, they have specific functions for those with visual impairment or total sight loss. AI-operated smart glasses, although having been available from 2023, have only become legally available in the UK to those with vision loss since April 2025. There are several manufacturers, all with slight variations of product, but all with the aim of providing sight and understanding of the environment to those who need visual assistance in their day-to-day lives. These AI smart glasses can do numerous tasks, mostly controlled by voice activation. For example, they can read aloud items like letters, signs, or menus. They can audio describe scenery around the wearer when out and about, including what street they might be on, and safety essentials such as the location of Pelican Crossings. When meeting up with familiar people, the glasses can learn these faces and then announce who they are to the wearer. In addition, certain brands of smart glasses have extra assistance features built in. For example, Envision glasses, which use the Google Glass Enterprise Edition 2 platform software, can support multi-languages, read handwriting, and even detect light levels. The Ray-Ban Meta smart glasses specialise in look-and-tell software, enabling the wearer to interact with advanced multimodal AI in the glasses by asking real-time questions about objects, reading material, or navigating environments. The glasses give immediate spoken responses, thus guiding the wearer and enhancing situational awareness. The only downside to these models of smart glasses is that they require linking to and the use of a smartphone and a special app to work. For anyone with some remaining usable vision, most smart glasses can include prescription lenses. Here are examples of three basic brand options. eSight offers high-resolution displays and real-time video processing of images seen by the wearer. Orcam MyEye 3 Pro includes a text, face, colour, money and barcode recognition device which can fit magnetically onto regular glasses. However, going forward, these glasses may not be as well supported as other brands as their functions are independent of the internet. Dot Lumen glasses are all about spatial awareness and helping the wearer safely navigate social and difficult scenarios such as crowded streets or staircases. They do this by utilising ultrasonic sensor information detected from obstacles in real time. So, there seems to be plenty of advantages of AI smart glasses, but what about the disadvantages? Currently, smart glasses offer only about 5 or 6 hours of battery life on a single charge, and surprisingly, some models are less water resistant than others in daily use. Also, like any electronic assistive technology, there may be times when the glasses lose power or break down. This makes it advisable to have a backup mobility aid to hand, such as a long cane, as an extra means of navigating your way around if necessary. With multiple options available, it's important to spend time working out which smart glasses can work best for you before investing your money. If you are considering a purchase, always make sure that you check several options to make sure that you find the glasses that are best suited to your individual requirements and lifestyle.
TNF Soundings.
Track 11, which brings issue number 1683 of the East Shropshire Talking newspaper to a close. A big thank you to everyone involved in putting it all together. Sound engineer John Wardle, editor readers Chris and Roy Grain, and resident sports expert Dave Gregory. From part two of this issue, thank you to Robert Green, Terry Frost and Suzanne Lawler. Also grateful thanks to everyone who works behind the scenes. For any feedback, queries or comments, our phone number is 01952 373 007. To email us, it's eastshropshiretn@gmail.com. And our website is eastshropshiretn.co.uk. The next issue will be recorded on Remembrance Day, Tuesday the 11th of November, when the presenter will be Joe Allam. With the clocks going back, it's getting darker so much earlier in the evenings now. Lighting up time is 4:34 p.m. Finally, on behalf of the team here at ESTN, a big thank you to you for listening. I'm Simon Martin, saying goodbye. Till next time.